practical wisdom that we want peace, because that is our real goal for well-being, and then to be competent to achieve the real goals. The challenge we have right now is that our political system is completely corrupt. It is based on money and narrow interests. For example, our Middle East policy, as we've been discussing, is determined by the Israel lobby, not by the common good, not by peacemaking, not by American interests. It's determined by a small group which spend a few hundred million dollars in a political cycle and then get hundreds of billions of dollars of returns on Pentagon outlays and other war-making efforts by the United States in return. In other words, our political system is completely plutocratic and completely corrupted. And so we don't choose the right goals. We have the goals set by very narrow groups. So what we need for competence is actually the capacity to understand the common good and then the technical knowledge to achieve it. Well, our government hasn't worked that way for a long time, and the American people overwhelmingly believe that America's heading in the wrong direction, which it is. But these are the two components of competence. Choose goals that are for the common good, and then have the competence to achieve them. And if the new government moves in that direction, it would be a breakthrough. It would be the first in decades in the United States, because we are definitely not in that direction in the most recent administrations. All of them, Clinton, Bush Jr., Obama, Trump 1, Biden, I regard as failures. So whether Trump 2 could change course, have the common good, and the competence to achieve it, well, that's the breakthrough we need.
Professor Jeffrey Sachs, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Great to be with you. I really appreciate it.
Jeffrey Sachs is an economist and public policy analyst at Columbia University. We'll link to Sachs's writings at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're visiting the site, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Bashar al-Assad's ouster and the decimation of Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon, Benjamin Netanyahu sets his sights on the last and biggest enemy state on this hit list Jeffrey Sachs and others speak about, Iran. Pressured by Netanyahu and deep-pocketed Israeli lobbyists in Washington, the incoming Trump administration may well greenlight a full-scale assault on the Islamic Republic, perhaps even with tactical nuclear weapons. Israel, of course, is the only nuclear-armed state in the region. By global standards, a small player. There are over 12,000 nuclear warheads on the planet, poised to be fired off at a moment's notice, most of them in the possession of the Americans and the Russians. Once upon a time, back in the 80s, this was the subject of intense debate in the media. It isn't anymore. It is a matter of huge concern for Ivana Nikolic Hughes. Hughes is the director of Frontiers of Science and senior lecturer in discipline in the Department of Chemistry at Columbia University in New York City. She's also the president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and has carried out research on the long-term radiological contamination of the Marshall Islands in the Central Pacific, where the United States carried out 67 atomic and hydrogen bomb tests between 1946 and 1958. I sat down with Ivana Nikolic Hughes in her office at Columbia University, a challenging campus to get into if you're not a student or faculty member, in the wake of protests against Israeli genocide in Gaza. Our conversation went on for about an hour and a half. We'll post the first part in an upcoming podcast. Here's the last half hour of my conversation with Ivana Nikolic-Hughes, focusing on the proposed Middle East nuclear-free zone. That'd be something. The Frontiers in Science program that Dr. Hughes teaches, the state of science awareness among her students, and the future of science-based policy under a Trump administration. The resolution to bring about a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East.
Yes.
Barack Obama, when he came in 2008, he was talking, we're going to do this, but it quickly dropped out of the picture. And it's of course, interesting because there is only one nuclear-armed state in the Middle East.
Of course.
And it is Israel.
Yes.
Which is undeclared.
Yes.
And, who knows, maybe they'll use a tactical nuclear weapon in Iran. Who knows?
Yeah.
But meanwhile, everybody's screaming about Iran going nuclear.
And it's very dangerous. I mean,
they won't force Israel out of the closet, right. Let alone say there's going to be a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. What are your thoughts on this?
I mean, let me just be clear. I think there are no good hands for nuclear weapons. I think no one should have nuclear weapons. I think we have to. I actually really believe the statement that John F. Kennedy made at the United Nations in 1961. He said, we must abolish nuclear weapons before they abolish us. And I think that's still very much the case. Right now in the world, we have two wars that are going on that involve both directly and indirectly nuclear armed states. That's, of course, the Ukraine war, and that's, of course, the Middle East. That conflict has been, I think, in my mind, as devastating as it could possibly be in terms of the civilian toll. But of course, it's spilling out into a regional war, carries with it a huge risk of nuclear weapons use, not just from Israel, which has nuclear weapons. Iran is probably on the order of weeks away from having a nuclear weapon. In fact, if they wanted one, they could have had it a long time ago.
And I've heard it said that, if I can put this crudely, yeah, right, if the Iranians are smart, they'd get a bomb because they're about to be assaulted, brutally assaulted. What's a country like Iran to do to defend itself against being assaulted?
Well, that's the whole thing of nuclear deterrence, this idea that somehow nuclear weapons keep us safe, but other countries are not allowed to have them. If that logic is really the what's happening, then why shouldn't Iran have a nuclear weapon? It would keep them safe, right? And everybody else should have a nuclear weapon. I mean,
yeah,
that's preposterous,
logic,
right?
The obvious logic of opposing Iran getting the bomb is that if Iran got the bomb, suddenly Israel's nuclear weapons arsenal, Israeli nuclear weapons and American nuclear weapons couldn't be used against Iran.
Right.
Because it wouldn't have the ability to retaliate.
Everything about nuclear deterrence is actually incredibly problematic because it quite simply disregards and ignores what it is that could happen if nuclear weapons were used today. And we're not in 1945. We're not at a time when one country had three weapons and tested one and used two. We're living at a time when there are 12,500 nuclear warheads spread across 9 nuclear armed states. Most of those warheads are in the possession of the US and Russia. And if U.S. and Russia were each to use about one-third of their arsenals, not only would 360 million people die from the attacks, that's the estimate, which is, of course, unimaginable and unthinkable, but at the same time, those attacks on cities, on infrastructure, would cause so much fires, widespread fires, that would release soot into the atmosphere, that would block incoming sunlight for years, and that would result in temperatures dropping around the planet by an estimated 10 to 15 degrees Celsius, completely turning this planet into a very different place, where food would stop to grow, where agriculture would fail, where we quite simply would begin to starve to death. And the estimates from that scenario I mentioned, with US and Russia using one-third of their arsenals, that estimate is 5.5 billion people starving to death within 2 years of a nuclear war. And if that doesn't convince people that these are weapons we have to, you know, that we must abolish these weapons, I don't know what would.
Do you talk about this in your Frontiers in Science?
I am actually speaking to Frontiers of Science students about this in, not this Monday, but the following Monday.
Now tell me about Frontiers of Science, your course.
Yeah, it's a core science course at Columbia. Columbia is very famous for having a 100-plus-year-old core curriculum, which for most of that history consisted of a set of courses in the primarily in the humanities, a year-long course in literature, a year-long course on political philosophy, a semester course on art, a semester course on music, and then a semester course on writing. And Frontiers of Science was added 20 years ago as in recognition of the increasingly important role science plays in our civilization, and that all students should also have exposure not just to these other courses, but also a common exposure to science. So what we do is we teach them about four topics, as the name of the course says, at the Frontiers of Science. And we also teach them how to do what we call scientific habits of mind, how to think scientifically. So we teach them sort of quantitative skills like statistics and probability and doing calculations. But we also teach them about having a sense of scale and being able to distinguish, you know, measurements and proxies and correlation and causation and lots of graph reading, for example, so that they can really make sense of graphical information. And the four topics that we do all of this in the context of are the first topic we call mind and brain. So that's a kind of neuroscience-focused unit. We do a second topic on physics and reality, and we cover topics like quantum mechanics and Einstein's theories of relativity and so on. And at times we've done nuclear weapons in that unit. We have our third unit is currently entitled Molecules and Life. And for a little while we were doing that in the context of the pandemic. Now we're focused on diseases and therapeutics with cancer kind of at the center. And then we always do, ever since I've been in the course, we've done a unit on climate, and we call that Climate and Us. And that's, of course, a different kind of existential threat to our world. I really do think that nuclear weapons are an existential threat to our world, but climate change is another one. It's a little bit different. It's not as immediate. If nuclear war were to happen today, Annie Jacobson, who wrote the book Nuclear War, A Scenario, tells us, and this comes from top experts that she's spoken to over the years, she tells us that nuclear war would take place over 72 minutes. So this is not 72 hours, you know.
The asteroid hitting the planet.
Yeah, exactly. That's basically what, and that was, it's interesting you bring that up, because that was what prompted scientists to think about nuclear winter. It was the realization that the asteroid had almost wiped out life on the planet, certainly wiped out the large dinosaurs, right? And then people thought about, wait a second, is there something that we could do today that could cause such large climatic changes and result in you know, mass extinction level of change, and that's how they first figured out what would happen in case of nuclear war and nuclear winter.
So I have two last questions to ask you. They're huge. Where are students? These students who take your Frontiers of Science. Like, where are their heads at, this younger generation? They're always on their smartphones and their, you know, social media and its attention spans of, I was talking about this with Glenn yesterday, it's not like attention span of 30 minutes or 15 minutes, is like about 90 seconds.
I know.
I don't want to malign your students.
I know.
So where are your students at in terms of this? And the second question is, Trump and his party are now, you know, January, they're going to be in power in the United States, and they're, I think it would be fair to say, fiercely anti-scientific, fiercely anti-science. They're going to empty out the EPA. I gather they're going to try to, you know, Robert Kennedy Jr. talking about, you know, got a list of 800 NIH, National Institute of Health, people who are going to go down the tubes.
Yes, let me say something about the students. I mean, for one thing, I do think we're incredibly lucky here at Columbia that we really do get very wonderful students. So I do feel very, very fortunate to teach very thoughtful, engaged young people. That's truly, truly a privilege. My experience is one that the most students, I mean, here really want to learn, and even if science wasn't their strong suit, you caught me at the end of a meeting with one of them. I actually spent last Friday and some of today meeting with my students one-on-one in 15-minute intervals to discuss their exam, their midterm exam, and how things are going in the course. And even students who may not have done as well, although most of them did very well on the exam, even students who may not have done as well have told me just how much they appreciate the course and how engaged they feel. And so in that sense, I'm very lucky.
And it's so
and
critical. We live in a time with, oh my God, like COVID and mRNA vaccines and artificial intelligence,
absolutely.
Climate change.
Absolutely. I mean, the science in many ways, I don't think it's any longer an option to say, oh, I'm not a science person, I'm not a scientist, I don't know this. Like, I think everyone needs to have a basic understanding of issues that really touch all of our lives, either as citizens when we're at the voting booth making decisions about whom to elect, but also in our personal lives, right? When we are faced with difficult decisions, such as medical decisions for ourselves or our loved ones. So I do very much care. I actually very much care that my students don't just believe something, like even climate change, right? Because someone told them, oh, maybe they align themselves with the values of, say, the Democratic Party, and now someone said climate change is real, so now they believe climate change. You know, I want them to think about everything, to evaluate everything, and to actually think that climate change is a problem, not because someone told them so, but because they understand the evidence that we have about what is happening to climate today, what we know about climate in the past. We actually know things about climate, what climate was like millions and hundreds of thousands of years ago. It's incredible. To me, that's incredibly inspiring to say we have these ways of knowing what climate was like, and now we can compare all that we know about past climate to what's happening today, and then figure out, like, is this us? Is this a natural thing? And it's not natural. It's totally us. It is true that climate has always changed in the past, but not at this rate, not in this fashion, not for these reasons.
So what are your thoughts, Ivana Nikolic, about the Trumpists coming in and the fate of science, the future of science?
I'm obviously concerned. I'm not the kind of person who blames the voters. I'm the kind of person who tries to look for why we are where we are, and what is it? And I think the fact that Trump won so decisively, I think speaks to the way in which, in my mind, the Democratic Party had betrayed the working class in this country. And I think they've also betrayed their anti-war label. And I think that allowing Trump to present himself as the peace candidate, I mean, to me, it's just, it's heartbreaking because the Democratic Party of Kennedy, JFK, John F. Kennedy, is the Democratic Party that stood for the working class and that stood for peace. I mean, JFK was arguably our last president who, really understood the danger of nuclear weapons, who understood the importance of cooperation, even when you didn't agree with your adversaries. He was able to put in place the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty, which I think saved potentially millions of lives, both here in the United States and elsewhere. So now I'm concerned, and I think, in my mind, even in the 1980s, in the 1960s, the period with Mothers for Peace, with public awareness, people like Linus Pauling, who won not just the Nobel Prize in chemistry, but also the Nobel Prize for Peace for his opposition to nuclear weapons more generally, but nuclear testing specifically. That was the 1960s were a time of great public awareness and some positive changes. The same was true in the 1980s, and were quite simply, I think that in many ways, peace and nuclear disarmament activists have kind of been left homeless, I'm concerned about where we will go with this administration for a number of reasons, including on scientific issues, as you yourself raised. But it wasn't like I was feeling safe with the Biden administration. It wasn't like I was happy with their response to Israel and Gaza. It wasn't like I'm happy with their with the warmongering when it came to Ukraine. I wrote a piece a few months into the Ukraine war saying, like, how could this even be happening? And here we are. We're about, next week will be 1,000 days since the start of the Ukraine war. And, of course, as a result, not only has Ukraine been devastated with hundreds of thousands of people, certainly hundreds of thousands of casualties, and even deaths, according to some estimates, but also with a risk of nuclear war, arguably higher than ever since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so I quite simply think that we need to get to a point where our leaders actually think about our well-being and where that comes first. I don't know.
It seems like sometimes I ask, there is no leadership. There's no statesmanship. There's no vision. There's no imagination. There's no capacity
willingness
to step out of the box.
Yes. And that is a willingness that you saw in Kennedy.
On the right.
Yeah.
Is this idea that I have, is that the extreme right in the United States, they say what they mean and they mean what they say and they do it. If they have the capacity, which they do, they will, starting in January, and they're gonna set out to do it, to burn the house down.
And in the 1980s, in 1982, Ronald Reagan, when Israel was bombing Beirut, Ronald Reagan made a phone call to the Israeli prime minister and said, you need to stop bombing women and children. And that was it. That was the end of that bombing campaign. We've had nothing like that from anyone, as far as I can tell, not from Biden. Harris wasn't saying this. She would do this. And I don't think it's coming from Trump either. And you also had in the 1980s, you had Reagan almost, I wish they had made the deal all the way, but he was thinking about nuclear abolition very, very seriously. He almost made a deal with Gorbachev, where both the U.S. and Soviet Union would have eliminated their nuclear weapons arsenals. The sticky point ended up being the Star Wars, missile project, where Reagan wanted that to keep going, and Gorbachev said, well, if we're going to eliminate them, then why do you need, interceptor missiles? And they didn't come to an agreement, but that there was such a large change in Reagan going from, he was going to use nuclear weapons, he was going to expand our arsenals, and he did up until 1986, to almost abolishing nuclear weapons was I think it's hard to say this because, of course, he was not. There were other things that he did during his presidency that are not exactly formidable. But at the same time, someone of his caliber was able to, at the very least, change their mind on this issue. To me, is inspiring. But we need much more. We need public awareness. We need excellent leadership with a vision, as you said. And we need people to be involved at all levels. The general public, now nobody speaks about this. It's as if these weapons don't exist. It's as if they will just go on to exist indefinitely without ever, destroying our world. It's quite simply not how it works.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Ivana Nikolic-Hughes is the director of Frontiers of Science and senior lecturer in discipline at Columbia University in New York City. She's also the president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and has carried out research on the long-term radiological contamination of the Marshall Islands in the Central Pacific, where the U.S. carried out 67 atomic and hydrogen bomb tests between 1946 and 1958. Hughes currently serves as a member of the scientific advisory group to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. We'll link to Ivana Nikolic-Hughes' writings at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Justine Willis-Toms, host of New Dimensions, heard Sundays from 9 to 10 a.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM. As you know, we are living in both challenging and exciting times, prompting more people to seek new solutions and to engage life more fully. New Dimensions explores vital topics with some of the world's leading thinkers, from science and religion to politics and medicine. Join me on Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. and together we'll explore New Dimensions on CJSF 90.1 FM, the station that is diverse, independent, and yours.
You're listening